Hey everyone, this is Adam Ellenboss from Nightlight Astrology. Today we're going to take a look at Venus's entrance into the sign of Pisces, which is the place of Venus's exaltation. In order to do this, I'm going to show you an episode from a previous series that I did some years ago called Planets in Profile, where I took Mercury, Venus, and Mars through all 12 signs and explored the archetypal significance of each of the planets through all of the signs. So today we're going to rewind that episode on Venus and Pisces to remind ourselves about the archetypal significations of Venus in her exaltation. The other reason this is important is that Venus is the host of the upcoming lunar eclipse in Libra, which is happening on March 25th. And then Venus is also going to be the host of the Jupiter-Uranus conjunction on April 20th. So what Venus is doing right now is of greater significance because she is sort of fueling two of the biggest transits of our spring. So on that note, I will be showing you that episode. And the other thing I want to point you to is that if you've never seen those episodes before, you can go back into the archives and look at the Planets in Profile series, and you can watch Mercury, Venus, or Mars through all 12 signs. So I like to just remind people once in a while of those videos by recycling this evergreen content when a planet ingresses into a new sign. The other thing to note is that we're in the midst of doing the moon through the 12 signs, and I think probably next week or the week after, you'll be seeing the next episode in that series, which will be the moon in Cancer. So a great way to learn more about planets and signs, really, and a nice appropriate one for this week as Venus has just entered Pisces. So that's it. Before we get into it, don't forget to like and subscribe. Share your comments and reflections. It really helps the channel to grow, as you guys know. Transcripts of any of the daily talks, including today's, can be found on the website, nightlightastrology.com. This Thursday night, we are really excited for the next in my monthly series of webinars. This is a series on the outer planets in love and relationships. So if you click on the events tab on the Nightlight website, go to live talks. And from there, you'll see you can register for Neptune in Love. That's this Thursday night, March 14th, 7 to 9 p.m. Eastern time. When you register for $20, you will get the link to attend the live webinar. It's about 2 hours long with a Q&A. And then we will be sending you the link to the recording afterward. If you can't make it live, that's nice because then you can watch it afterward. Or even if you want to watch it a second time, if you attend live, you can also check out Uranus in Love on April 18th. If you missed Pluto in Love last month, you can pick the recording up as well in the shop or on the events page. Now, one thing to note about this series is that it's totally okay for beginners, and it's specific enough that I think advanced students will get something good out of this too. But we're looking at the outer planets and how they show up either in the natal chart or transits to the natal chart with respect to the topic of love, sex, and relationships and what we can learn from them. So that is the agenda of that series. Be sure to check that out. The other thing that I am promoting right now is my wife's herbal apprenticeship program. Ashley's Herbal Foundations apprenticeship begins on April 24th. You can learn more about it on the website, skyhouseherbs.com. So if you go over to skyhouseherbs.com and you click on the courses tab, go to Herbal Foundations apprenticeship, scroll down to learn more about it. And if you stick around at the end of today's video, you will see an interview that I've tagged on to the end where I talk to Ashley about the program, and you can learn more about it if you haven't watched that interview already. So that is it for announcements. And on that note, we will rewind and check out this Planets in Profile episode, exploring the deeper meaning of Venus in Pisces. So I hope you guys will enjoy this, and we will see you again tomorrow. Hi, everybody. This is Adam Ellenboss from Nightlight Astrology, and this is another episode of Planets in Profile. In today's episode, we're going to take a look at Venus in the sign of Pisces. Now, if you're new to this series, I've been tracking the movements of Venus and Mars through the 12 signs, somewhat this year in 2019, some last year in 2018. So I will be looking at all of the planets eventually in this series, but right now I'm just looking at Venus and Mars through the signs in particular. So we've gone through quite a few signs, and in today's episode, like I said, we're going to be looking at Venus in the sign of Pisces, which is an interesting place for Venus because this is the place of Venus's exaltation. So it's a very powerful place for Venus, and there are reasons for this that are really interesting, which we're also going to take a look at. So let's go ahead and get into it. Basically, the thing that you need to know about
Venus in Pisces is that this is the place where Venus is said to be exalted. Another way of thinking about exaltation is to think about a planet in its exaltation as being lifted on high or being lifted up. So it has a kind of exalted status. It sort of has a worshipable feeling. It has the feeling of being sometimes very powerful. It can sort of point to fame or high levels of success or good fortune. Anytime a planet is exalted, you know, in the language of traditional astrology, it's a little like, ooh. For example, it's Aries season right now. The sun is in Aries. That's the exaltation of the sun. So the sun is lifted on high in Aries. Every planet has a place where it's exalted. Every planet also has a place in the opposite sign of its exaltation where it's said to be depressed or in its fall. The basic meaning of an exaltation or depression has to do with the concept of fortune. All exaltations and falls are related to the moon, who is the ruler of fortune. What is fortune? It's the world of change, the world of material fluctuations and change that moves in cycles and rhythms, as opposed to, or in relation with, the unmoved center of being, the pure conscious soul or the pure conscious identity that we are, which is in a sense an observer and an unmoved mover, connected to the idea of God or divinity. So in ancient astrology, there is a kind of pure consciousness, and then there are things that change and move and revolve around it. We can see this from the fact that the entire meaning of the sequence of the zodiac is derived from the idea of the zodiac revolving around a pole star that does not change. And the fixed rhythms of the cycles of the seasons that repeat over and over again are moving in a circle of change and fluctuation that moves around an unchanging center. So when we're talking about exaltations, what we're talking about is something happening within that realm of cyclical change, which is the material world that we live in, which is our bodies, which is the highs and lows of life. And when a planet is exalted, it is said to indicate things relative to the natural significations of the planet that are of high, exalted, lofty, good, usually sort of good fortune, which is to say they're at a high point. So Venus is the natural ruler of love, beauty, harmony, sensuality, the senses, desire, jealousy and envy, lust, betrayal. These are all things that Venus can represent, as well as friendship, the arts, pageantry, jewelry, the beauty of flowers and nature. So these are all things that Venus can naturally represent, right? So when she is in her exaltation, it's said that these qualities are all exalted. They're all sort of lifted up on high. So that's what that's what it means to say Venus is exalted in Pisces. But then we have to ask the question, well, why? Why is Venus exalted in the sign of Pisces? There's good reason for this. The main reason is that Pisces is the sign that comes just before the spring equinox, when all of the quality of light during the solar year is moving towards a takeover of the yang being the light principle, which is more closely related to the idea of that unchanging center. We can see this because as we are approaching in Pisces season, the spring equinox, the light of the sun is growing and the days are getting longer, and the sun is moving, the arc of the sun, the ecliptic pathway of the sun is moving higher and higher toward the pole star in the north. As it lifts up, it's aspiring upward. So we have in Pisces the very end of winter and the shifting and changing into the yang or sort of solar half of the year, where everything is reaching high upward toward that pole star on the spring side. And so that's where we get that kind of aspirational Venusian quality from. This is Jupiter's home sign. Pisces is the feminine abode of Jupiter. It's called a double-bodied water sign. And it is double-bodied because it's coming out of winter, as we just said, but going into spring. So it's of two natures, has a little bit of winter, but is aspiring to come out of the darkness into the light. So you always have this really two-sided nature to planets in Pisces. On the one hand, a planet in Pisces tends to represent someone, kind of something or someone potentially grappling with something a little dark or a little heavy or a little depressive, a little wintry, a little dark and soulful. And then we have the other quality of moving toward the light. Let me aspire upward and outward, you know? And so there's this kind of conflicted relationship between darkness and light with an overall aspirational quality toward the light. So we say it's of two natures. It's double bodied. It's watery and feminine. It's very moody, feeling oriented sign. And it's aspirational like Jupiter. It's heading upward towards some bigger, unchanging ideal at the top. Now, because of that, because spring is on the rise and the light is on the rise and we're moving out of winter, Venus is exalted here because Venus is related to springtime qualities and to life and the proliferation of life and to sex and to birth and like proliferation of plant life when it rains and it's warm outside. These are all Venusian qualities. On the other hand, if you put Venus in Virgo, Venus is in her fall. This is because it's a hot, a kind of dry time of summer, and things are declining down into the death of fall and autumn, where all of the natural Venusian qualities are falling. And so we say that Venus is exalted here because at this point, that kind of the appetite, the desire, the beauty, the sensuality of spring is stirring and rising to life. So this is considered to be a high place for Venus, a place that's naturally suited to Venus's romantic, imaginative qualities. And it's a water sign. Everything's getting wet and everything's starting to come to life around this time of year, Pisces time of year. Now, Venus can never be more than a couple of signs away from the sun. So for Venus in Pisces, and like all planets, really, it doesn't have to be literally spring where you live or at the time of your birth for Venus to express these qualities in a person's life. These are archetypal qualities. They're symbolic. They're derived. They express themselves through the seasonal archetypes, but they're not caused by them. Okay, so now that's the, in fact, ancient astrologers have it just the opposite way, that these natural archetypal qualities are what cause nature to express itself in the way that it does, not the other way around. But at any rate, so another thing to note is that when Venus is traveling through Pisces, she is in the home of Jupiter. So wherever she is, and whenever she's in Pisces, you always have to look at Jupiter. Where is Jupiter? She's an exalted house guest in Jupiter's sign. This is another benefic planet that's related to very similar qualities, life, growth, proliferation, the great green light in the sky. That's Jupiter. Venus is very similar. They both rule the benefic aspects, like the sextile for Venus and the trine for Jupiter. When Venus is in Jupiter's sign, she enjoys benefits from friends, from lovers, from people who are important, because you're looking at Venus significations, receiving benefits, lovers, friends, harmonious connections, anything that's, you know, beautiful or sensual is basically on the rise and is going to grant blessings or typically be favorable. So that's, you know, very important. But you have to look at where Jupiter is. If Jupiter, when you're born, if you have Venus in Pisces and Jupiter's in a really bad house and you know, pretty like messed up with its dignity or something else, or receiving some hard aspects from Saturn or whatever, that will affect Venus. And so it's always a very nuanced interpretation. Anytime you're looking at a planet in a birth chart, it's never as simple as being like, oh, well, Venus in Pisces is just like this. It always has to do with Venus knowing the dignity, knowing the tendencies of the sign that it's in, how it relates to that sign, and also knowing where the planetary host is and what kind of relationship they that Venus has to the planetary host. If Venus can't see the planetary host, is an aversion to it in ancient terms, or is within a sextile or trine to Jupiter, or is in an opposition or a square. If Jupiter's well dignified or not, you know, depending on Jupiter's condition in the chart, the whole thing is modified. So I say this not to discourage you. You can still hopefully gain a lot from hearing about Venus in Pisces, but also because people will sometimes be like, well, my life is nothing like that, or I don't have anything like that going on in my life, and I have Venus in Pisces. One of the reasons for this is that often enough, we're not looking carefully enough at the condition of Venus in aspectual relation, in house dynamics, or in terms of its host Jupiter. So those are some good things you always have to consider when looking at Venus traveling through the home sign of Jupiter. She's a house guest. Yes, she's an exalted house guest, which means she really gets along well with Jupiter. And Jupiter gives her a lot of good things, blessings, augmentation, growth. But, you know, it's always a tricky situation to look at the nuances of all the planets involved. So now what is Venus in Pisces? How does Venus in Pisces behave? What can we say about Venus in Pisces? Well, first of all, we're going to say that she is Jupiterian. She's very happy in a feminine abode. She's very happy in Jupiter's home as well. So she expresses herself in grandiose ways, right? And like, that's not bad for Venus, right? Like, think about a beautiful play, a theatrical performance, and think about the over-the-top colors and voices and songs and dance and the bodies, the amazing bodies of dancers. All of these things are, in a sense, when you see it all on stage and the lights and you're taken into it, that's very Venus in Pisces. If you've ever been to Disney World before, some people can't stand Disney World. I get it. I was kind of taken by the magic of it with a three-year-old recently. So Venus in Jupiter's sign of Pisces is sort of like the over-the-top characteristics of Disney World, the magic, the imagination, the costume, the colors, the dancing. You know what I mean? It has that feeling to it. So anything that is Venusian, naturally, from theater, performing arts, romance, beauty, friendship, love, harmony, music, desire, can become greatly enhanced, made much, much bigger, because that's what Jupiter does. Jupiter augments and makes things grow and makes them bigger and larger and sometimes over the top, like way too grandiose, way too big. And the part where this can get a little troubling with Venus in Pisces is that we have to remember that even though Venus is very happy in Pisces and it represents a natural peak in fortune, like when Venus arrives in the sign of Pisces, it's usually like pretty celebratory, like, hey, everything's going pretty well. I'm enjoying really nice connections with people. I'm feeling like I'm really in love with my friends, or I'm falling in love with someone, or having a lot of nice romantic outings or something like that, right? But there's also this duality built into Pisces. There's the part of Pisces that is still like the first 15 degrees of Pisces, we say, versus the second 15. First 15, more like winter. Second 15, okay, spring's coming on. So there's a duality, and the darkness of Pisces has to do with wrestling with that which is fallen, or that which is complicated, that which is dark, and that which is more soulful, right? So not all of that is bad either. For example, let's look at some personalities and see how they express this duality. Let's talk about, for example, Kurt Cobain. Kurt Cobain, Venus in Pisces, right? Granted, he had his conjoined with Saturn, but Venus in Pisces in his chart, he's someone who doesn't like false. He's not he's a grunge rocker, right? He doesn't fit the typical, like, oh, everything's grandiose and romantic and. No, but he is still romantic in the sense of being tragic. And that's the dark side of Pisces, right? Is that entanglement with the material world that says, I love you, but I hate you. I want you, but I reject you. Like an addict, for example, I can't be here. It's brutal here. I need a drug. I need something to make me feel better. But then I want the drug and it makes me feel better, but then it's a poison and I can't get rid of it. I need to get rid of it. So that kind of tortured back and forth between having a body and being in the material world and feeling like it's a horrible entangling web of karma and illusion, but then also, you know, feeling so much compassion and love and being able to see the shimmering of divinity within it. Is this place good or is it bad? I can't decide. I'm torn apart. Is it a dream? Is it beautiful or is it a nightmare? Right. This kind of duality that exists in Pisces can bring out this kind of romantic, grandiose quality as well as a real tragic romantic quality. And obviously, if you read Shakespeare at all, you know that one of the greatest love stories of all time is also a tragedy in Romeo and Juliet. So there's this feeling of the complicated relationship that we have with life here, the life in the world where it's dark and it's wintry sometimes, and we're very entangled with the world here. We're like addicts of the material world. We can't get enough complexity. We can't get enough stuff, right? But then, and then when we want to leave, we want to go to a high, we want to seek higher ground. We want to find religion, spirituality, something that really liberates or frees us. That's the movement upward and outward into spring, but we keep getting pulled down. On the other hand, we don't want, you know, I appreciate people like Marilyn Manson, right? Who absolutely, like in similar fashion to Kurt Cobain, does not want some kind of rosy, happy-go-lucky superficiality. Don't give me some Jupiterian, you know, like half-baked, you know, smiley face, right? If I'm going to see something beautiful, then I want it to be real. You know what I mean? So there's that real dichotomy. It doesn't sound like Jupiter on the outset. On the outset, people are like, that doesn't sound like Jupiter or Venus in Pisces. It should also be so rosy. But no, because we're talking about a true winter sign, but it's a yin sign. It's dark, but it has this kind of aspirational quality. So the feminine abode of Jupiter is like that. It's more conflicted about the light. No surprise that people who have tried to rectify a chart for Jesus Christ always give him Venus in Pisces, right? If you look on whatever it is, Astro Theme or I don't remember which website it is, but and I looked up, you know, celebrities with Venus in Pisces, and the top of the list was Jesus. And I was like, well, it makes sense, right? Here's someone who represents the conflict of the material world and the darkness of it, the crucifixion, but then the rebirth and the resurrection. So there's this also the side of Pisces that wants to bring the darkness into the light, but not in a way. Often you'll see this with Venus and Pisces individuals, not in a way that's cheap or that denigrates, leaves behind, or casts out something valuable, right? So there's this very compassionate, this longing for everything to be included, even the darkness. Now that's Jupiter in a feminine sign, because Jupiter wants everything included. Jupiter is all about making bigger holes, but the dark yin half of the year is really reflective of our material condition and how complicated it is here and how heavy and how much suffering there is here. So what is it that can embrace all of that suffering and bring it through? That's why you have the associations of Venus and Pisces with saints and martyrs and great sinners and, you know, people who have kind of complicated, tragic personalities. Okay, so let's give you a list of them, like Martin Luther King Jr. Well, that's pretty obvious. There's a martyr for a cause. I have a dream, right? Notice, I always like this phrase. It wasn't, I have a plan. It was, I have a dream. It's a real visionary quality. Sorry if you can hear that. Somebody's working on my house outside. Justin Bieber, he's a complicated character. Same thing. He's taking time off from his work right now because of mental health problems. Yet he's this beloved kind of tragic rock icon. Kurt Cobain, same thing. His love life got involved with heroin in a really complicated way. But he was kind of this, the sun is gone, but I have a light. He's a very complicated personality, but both beautiful artist and also sort of tragic. Heath Ledger, same thing. Vincent van Gogh, same thing. And very post-impressionistic artist. Look at his artwork. Look at Vincent van Gogh's artwork. It has this quality of seeing something more in the world than what people commonly see. But it's not transcending the world. It's bringing something out of the world that's there already. That's a very important Piscean quality. Marilyn Manson, goth glam rocker. Penelope Cruz, beautiful dancer, but a kind of dark beauty. George Harrison, who was the spiritual member of the Beatles and became a bhakti yogi, joined the Hare Krishna movement. Same thing. And he was, by the way, he had his, if you ever watched the documentary, Living in the Material World, I think it's called, brilliant about the spiritual legacy of his work. Edgar Cayce, similar thing. He's a famous psychic who, has this very complicated relationship to spirits and ghosts and, you know, dark things, but also has this kind of prophetic quality. Edgar Allan Poe, a dark, tragic poet who's, it's beautiful, but it's dark. Billie Holiday, same thing, really troubled childhood, very complicated, soulful, dark, beautiful singer. Jules Verne, epic around the world in however many days, I forget it, it was 80 days or something. Journey to the Center of the Earth, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. All of these grand adventures that capture the imagination, but they're very grandiose and Jupiterian. Maya Angelou, similar thing. I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings. Beauty and darkness combined, but with a redemptive kind of message. Sometimes tragic, but there's something beautiful about tragedy with all of these characters. Galileo, well beyond his time, a visionary, but also a martyr. Similar to Martin Luther King, moves everyone forward, but is caught up in the darkness of humanity. Marvin Gaye, similar character, peace lover, and yet he gets moved out of the he's murdered by his own father, if I remember correctly. Ravi Shankar, which is also he's a brilliant musician and one of the most well-known musicians in India and a fantastic spiritualist as well. Jack Kerouac, crazy problems with drugs and tragedy, but in his life, in a sense, really sick as an individual, possessed with addiction and things like that, but a brilliant poet who moves us beyond the trappings of the material world to try to find something more. All of these characters are like this. They have that duality built into them, but there's inherently in them, there's something uplifting and hopeful. Even if the life is tragic, there's something that makes us feel like there was a bright, bright star in them that burned out, like Heath Ledger, Kurt Cobain, Martin Luther King, even George Harrison to a certain extent. There's a feeling in his youth like he was someone who was instrumental to creating a yogic movement all over the world with the Hare Krishnas, which of course is very important to me since I study bhakti. So you get the feeling for Venus in Pisces. There's this built-in duality, and it needs the darkness and the soulfulness and the complications of being in the material world have to be addressed. And usually it comes out through a love, a way of glamorizing darkness, a way of embracing it and trying to lift it up, a way of eulogizing someone or something, a way of dreaming something forward. So it's like that. But remember, exaltations, a planet in its exaltation is almost always related to a planet in its fall. What goes up must come down. So there's always, in exalted planets, there's always some sense of a potential for something that's really high up to fall down. What burns bright and fast and lifts up high, you know, it goes out fast and falls down. That's built into the meaning of Venus in Pisces as an exalted planet. So hopefully this has been interesting to you guys. I'm going to try to get out of this one a little bit early before I say too much and before the banging outside becomes too annoying. I hope you can't hear it too much. thank you all for listening. I hope that you, if you have questions or comments, reflections on Venus and Pisces, please share. I'm going to be doing a new one pretty soon on Mars and Gemini as well. So stay tuned for that. All right. Take care, everyone. Bye.
Hey, everyone. Thanks so much for sticking around. I'm really happy to be joined by my wife, Ashley, who is an herbalist. Hi, Ashley.
Hey.
And yeah, I'm really excited to be helping Ashley promote her upcoming program, which is something that you actually began teaching many years ago, this herbal apprenticeship program. I think it was, what, 2011 or 12 that it got started, right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So it's been over 10 years I've been offering this course. And yeah, it's my favorite thing to teach.
Yeah. And just to be clear, because some people on my channel, most people know you because you pop on here or there. We talk about herbs and astrology. There's an attraction in our marriage and an attraction in the subject matter that is old. Like we've been together for, 14 years in our relationship going on. And we've always had a fascination with each other's areas of expertise. And we've done lots of things to marry them together over the years, in addition to literally getting married. And and actually, herbalists and astrologers have married the subjects of herbs and planets together for thousands of years as well. Now, your program is focused on herbalism. It's not an astrology course, but there is certainly a lot of overlap in terms of the energetics and the spiritual approach to herbalism that you take. And so I was hoping that we could start off just by telling people a little bit about the program. You're coming to this after taking a little bit of time on maternity leave. Our kids were not yet in school. Now they are. You're coming back to work. This is really exciting. The new program launches at the end of April. I'm going to put it up on the screen so people can see it. You can find it at skyhouseherbs.com. Enrollment is open now. The course begins. You go under Courses, Herbal Foundations Apprenticeship at the end of April. Tell us about it.
Well, this course, I guess my goal in redesigning the apprenticeship course that I've been teaching for 10 years is to make it even more personal and to allow people to study the material, digest it at their own pace. So what it's going to be is a combination of kind of three main parts. The first one is the recorded material. So there's going to be modules that will be released and people can listen to them as they, as they have time. The second part are live classes where we will meet live on Zoom and talk about the module, I'll answer questions, I'll give even more information about it. And then the third part is the sacred plant pairings. And so I've always taught the herbal portion, like the plant diets, one at a time, but this year I'm going to do it in pairs because I think you can learn a lot by comparing and contrasting herbs. So for every module, you'll have two herbs to study and you'll get a little cheat sheet about them before you start the module. And then you'll have an opportunity to work with those two plants and blend them and keep them separate and just really work with them closely. Because my goal is that I want people to be able to find information that they can really use in their own lives, maybe with clients, whether they have a professional herbal practice or maybe they're a therapist in a different field, that they'll know these plants so that they can work with them really comfortably.
I love the different modules that you have, just so we can preview them for people. Module one is Vitalism and the Heart of Herbalism. Module two, Building Your Home Apothecary. They're so diverse. I love module three is my favorite, Plant Spirit Medicine, Energetics and Chemistry. You have such a holistic approach. It's what I've always loved about your teaching. You'll teach about the doctrine of signatures. You'll talk to people about how to communicate with plants, how to think of them as teachers that are living beings, that have personalities that aren't just, phytochemistry or whatever. But you will also teach phytochemistry. And I think that you have this really well-rounded way of helping people be intelligent about the plants, about the body, about the systems of the body, but also not afraid to use energetic systems, not afraid to take something from the kinds of energetics that ancient mystics were working with, whether that's the elements or whether that's, some of the overlay with things like Ayurveda, Chinese medicine. You take what's useful on a symbolic and energetic plane and on a personal connection level with the plants, and you marry it to really smart scientific research. I think that that's rare. You don't see that a lot.
Well, thank you for saying that. Yeah. To me, it's all language. They're just different languages that we talk about the same thing. And I think the more diverse our languages as herbalists, the more we can reach more people. And that's kind of my goal. Like, I want everyone to like be able to identify plants, use plants. So we need to diversify the languages we speak. So we can talk with our physicians. So we can talk with a therapist. We can talk with a mystic, right? We can talk with children. And we have a language that everyone can use.
You talk in the program, in your modules, you have stuff on digestive and gut health. You have stuff on detoxification, colds and flus, and, you know, dealing with virus seasons. You talk about tissue states, and you're talking about how to give things to your kids for, you know, helping them maybe at times even relax before bed at night. We use a lot of different things with our kids. I love this, that you have called this a, I'm going to find the phrase where you use that you use, and I'm going to mess it up, a community herbalist. What is a community herbalist, so that people can understand that definition? Because sometimes people might look at a course like this and think, gosh, unless I go to an accredited university for, you know, 8 years and learn all about chemistry, I have no right or business suggesting herbs to people or using herbs. That's just not true. And that's not the history of how folk herbal medicine has been used or taught. So what do you mean when you say community herbalist?
I think you said it perfectly. This is the people's medicine, and our grandmothers and great grandparents used plants as medicine. There's nothing actually that like hard about the practice of herbal medicine. It's just getting to know the plants and getting to know the times when they're most useful. I really envision that this course, people can take it and yes, use it for themselves, number one, because I think a lot changes when we have the personal experience, and then using it in your family, whether that's just, you know, maybe making a tea for your dog, or, you know, if you have kids, or maybe you just have a partner, maybe you have plants you can use, and we'll talk about taking care of a garden, but using it for yourself, for whoever's immediately around you, and then taking it beyond that, because it's likely that at some point, you're going to be talking with someone. They're going to say, oh, you know, I've got this digestion thing and I've tried this and this. And they might say, hey, you're studying herbs. Is there anything that you would recommend? And you know what? You'll probably have a few ideas. And that, you know, you never know how one way that you help someone out there in the world might trickle and then help others and more people. So I think through the self-knowledge and studying this knowledge in your own body, it'll naturally, it's like, you know, impossible for it not to spread out and start to affect the broader community.
Yeah, I think that's really important. This is also for that reason, because we have a vision. I mean, you guys know through my Kickstarter, you guys helped us build a community herbal medicine garden that Ashley's been hosting free and donation-based events out of, that the donations go back to right back into the garden and just growing the medicine that we then find ways of harvesting and giving to other people or letting other people come and harvest. We have a vision, we always have, back to the days when we had our yoga studio in Maryland, we have always had a vision of making this sacred knowledge accessible to people. And that is both there in this program in terms of the way you're framing what it means to be an herbalist. It might mean that you're a professional and you see clients and you could continue beyond this program developing the skills to do that. This would certainly set you up for success. You could also go forward and be someone who uses what you know with friends and family and yourself. And that's an incredible set of tools to have. The program's also very accessible from both a programming standpoint and a price standpoint. I'll take you back over and show everybody. The programs, the modules are pre-recorded, but then you meet outside of the modules for discussion, community, Q&A, and sort of development and integration. So people can attend those live. If they miss those integration sessions, they can also watch the replays of those. So
absolutely, yeah.
Anyone could take this at their own rate, you know, as slowly or as quickly as you wanted to, really soak it in, or blaze through it. And, you know, and then we can certainly, beyond this program, as Ashley perhaps makes more advanced programs available as she's easing back in out of maternity leave, can help you with further development or recommend you to many other wonderful programs where you could continue your studies. We want this to be accessible. We want community herbalism to be, you know, as simple as being able to show a friend a couple of yoga stretches. We should be able to show each other herbs, you know, and just, hey, this is a helpful herb to use. Also, accessibility price-wise, we have an early bird enrollment and we have a standard enrollment. And then we have tuition level 1 assistance and tuition assistance level 2, which break out the affordable tuition into different levels of affordability. And you can kind of identify where you're at if you're someone who wants to take this program, but needs to work within your means and not hurt yourself doing it. And then for those who can pay, we ask that you use standard or early bird enrollment. And that's the same thing I do for all my astrology programs. So we try to keep it super, super accessible. The Herbal Apprenticeship Program starts April 24th. I know Ashley's super excited to be getting back into teaching too. I also would like to offer Ashley just a chance to tell everyone a little bit about, before we end here this interview, tell everyone maybe a little bit about your own background, who you studied with, what your influences are, and just anything else you want to say before we cap it off.
Ooh, okay. well, I think, you know, I started off as a kid playing in the woods, mixing perfumes and potions. And then I went on to study environmental science, where I studied organic chemistry and restoring native wetlands. And really from an environmental perspective, that's how I got into herbalism. And then after, you know, I realized after working on the restoration piece and joining a lot of earth advocacy groups that the problem's not with the earth, but with the people not mm-hmm. understanding the value of the earth. So then I started going into holistic medicine. I graduated from University of North Carolina, Asheville with a degree in interdisciplinary studies. And I went on to get my, that was my undergrad. And then I got my master's from the Maryland University of Integrative Health. It was then called Thai Sophia. But my teachers there, you know, I had such a great blend of teachers, really scientific minds, like Simon Mills from the UK and Kevin Spellman, who is like a chemistry genius. He's also an Ayurvedic practitioner, studied with Dr. Vasant Lad. Matthew Prisco, medicine maker from Galen's Way out in California. So I had a really wonderful, diverse variety of teachers in that 3-year full-time master's level program. And then after that, I went on to study with Matthew Wood pretty intensively because I liked his energetics. I liked the way he spoke about the plants and his personal experience working with low dose, drop dose medicine. And he has had amazing, he's done such amazing work herbally with just using that method. And I've got a lot of herbalists in my basket.
David Duke comes to mind.
Margie Flint, Rosemary Gladstar is like, I've only done one herb walk with her, but it was amazing. So, you know, I have shelves of herbal books and people who I just adore. Yeah. And yeah, I just feel really grateful that I've had that blend of the science and the energetic herbalism and the traditional herbalist perspective as well. And I try my best to blend them together and to give everyone a really diverse yet integrated herbal studying experience.
Yeah, absolutely. You get that. That is exactly what you'll get if you sign up for Ashley's program, which I encourage you to do. If this is the kind of thing that interests you, you won't regret it. It's a fantastic course with someone I absolutely love, obviously, but also like a really, truly fantastic human being and teacher of plant medicine. And if you want to learn more about her, see her work, get to know her a little bit, check out her YouTube channel, Skyhouse Herbs, where she publishes weekly on plant medicine, plant energetics, and also on Instagram, which is Skyhouse Herbs. So the apprenticeship program starts April 24th. I wanted to get Ashley on, brag about her program, turn you guys on to it. Thank you so much for being here. And I'm sure that we're going to see some people from the Nightlight astrology world getting introduced to you and all of your magic.
I would love that. Thank you.
All right. Take it easy, everyone. Bye.